Welcome, and thank you for listening to Tim Blackett and Friends. After what felt like a whirlwind of a start for me in October and November with two quick episodes, I had a brief hiatus for a few months, but I'm back with episode 3 featuring Jessica Johns and our conversation regarding her novel Bad Cree. I have been working hard on this thing because I love this project and I'm getting a lot out of it. So I have organized and I have already secured recording dates with at least 3 other guests. Catherine Mockler will be joining us to talk about anecdotes. Minda Honey will be coming on the show to talk about the heartbreak years. And Chelsea Wakelin is coming to talk about what remains of Elsie Jane. I'm very excited for all 3 interviews. On top of that, I have a whole list of other guests that I'm working to coordinate recording times with, so stay tuned. I should be able to put out consistent episodes at least once a month moving forward, and I'm happy about that. For now, though, thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jessica Johns.
A one, two, three, four. Tim Blackett, baby, dabba doo, deep dee bop bop doo, ribby deep dee bop dabba doo, bow, deep dee bop bop doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep doo, bibby deep bop bop doo. Tim Blackett, baby, deep deep, dibby deep deep. Tim Blackett, baby, deep deep, dibby deep deep bop. Tim Blackett, baby, deep tip tip tip. Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett and Friends.
I first came across Jessica Johns' work on a table at Indigo labeled Your Next Spooky Read or something of the like. I was drawn to it because of the cover, a sort of metallic red number with 3 crows hanging on a telephone wire, Cree lettering under the title Bad Cree. I can't help myself around books with birds on the cover to begin with, and as crows are my favorite animal, I had to pick it up. I'm only slightly ashamed to say I didn't buy it that day. I read a bit of the synopsis, flipped through the pages, but eventually set it back down. Spooky books, which I assume meant horror books, are not my typical jam. And so I added it to a note in my phone labeled Maybe, which is a list I've compiled made up of books that almost counted as impulse buys, but have moved into a pile of books that I might buy later when I need a pick-me-up. It wasn't long, though, before I started seeing more and more people talking about the book on various TikTok videos, all of them declaring it's one of the best they've read in 2023, all of them saying they were surprised by it in different ways, all of them telling me I should have picked it up the other day, if only I wasn't so foolish. I read it in October of last year, and I was taken up in a story unlike any I had read before. It didn't feel like horror to me, though there are some spooky bits, nightmares come to life, ghostly visits from the past, etc. To me, it felt more like a love story. The love between sisters, between mothers and daughters, friends, cousins, aunties, and a love story to nature and the land one has been separated from. I was taken up with the story in a way I had not expected, even as the chorus of book talkers had said I would be. And now, having read it through a second time, I think it's no wonder Jessica Johns has become an important and respected voice amongst Canadian letterers, and especially amongst Indigenous voices in Canadian literature. Bad Cree was shortlisted for the Amazon Canada First Novel Award. It was a CBC Books Best Book of the Year in 2023, an American Library Association Alex Award winner, and was recently chosen as a Canada Read selection for 2024. Jessica has published short stories, poetry, and nonfiction all over the Canadian scene of literary zines and journals, as well as in the Globe and Mail. She's a visual artist and, according to her TikTok page, an avid jigsaw puzzle solver. I am honored and very excited to have her on the podcast. Jessica Johns, welcome to Tim Blackett and Friends.
Wow, that was such a great introduction. Thank you. I mean, I love hearing about your journey to Bad Cree, you know, like seeing it somewhere and then, you know, returning to it. I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, I was surprised by it in a lot of different ways. I'm glad I picked it up.
Well, me too.
Yeah. So, welcome to the pod. I guess I wanted to start off by talking a bit about your writing life. Have you always been a writer? How did that start, kind of thing? And what does your writing life look like now? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I've always been a writer, but I've certainly always been a storyteller. I've always loved stories. Even as a kid, when I think back to memories of me as a kid, so much of it I just spent in my head. So me and my family, I grew up in northern Alberta, in, you know, various places, Peace River, High Prairie as is the setting in Bad Cree, Rainbow Lake, and then and always kind of moving south. And yeah, all my memories are, being living on our farm, and just always sort of making up stories. Just really, I was a really in my head person. And I think it was when I was 9, I actually wrote my first story. It was called Daniel the Diplodocus. It was about a dinosaur. I
Cool.
illustrated it myself as well. I got my mom to like bind the book. She still has it in her in her like keepsakes
That's
as
awesome.
my first actual book. That was actually the first book. And I just, yeah, I've always loved it. And then after that, I grew up in, I'm 35, so my MySpace and LiveJournal and things like that were really like when I was 14 to 17 or whatever. That was like where I put my life, and those websites are now defunct. They don't exist anymore, thank God. But yeah, I was always sort of, I've always considered myself a storyteller, even I think before I had the language for really identifying that way, or had the confidence of really identifying that way. It wasn't until I did my undergrad at McEwen University in Edmonton, and my last year I did my degree, my undergraduate degree in English, as there weren't any creative writing classes offered at McEwen at that time. But in my last year, Jacqueline Baker, who is a really great Canadian writer, she was hired and started the first creative writing classes, and I took those. And it was at that time that I really sort of bit the bullet of being like, okay, I am a writer. This is actually what I want to do. So instead of just sort of living in my head and living sort of secretly as a writer, I was like, okay, I want to pursue this thing. I actually want to, make this my career. And so it was after that time that I, applied for grad school and then attended the University of British Columbia for writing. And yeah, the rest is sort of the history of it. I really dove in. I started working at literary magazines. I started just writing as much as possible and submitting as much as possible, mostly getting rejected, but sometimes getting published, until I'm here having written my debut novel.
That's awesome. I'm always interested in the origin stories of other writers.
Yeah, me too.
We all have different ways of coming to this way of living or creating art or whatever, and it's always interesting for me.
Yeah, I love hearing about people's journeys too, because there's no one way to becoming a writer. Like the way that I didn't go to grad school until I was 27 when I went. And I met in my cohort, there were writers who had spent their entire undergrad, that was their undergraduate experience, was they were in writing, and so they had been writing for a lot longer than I had, and I felt sort of behind. And there are lots of people who, start writing later than that, and who don't go the school route at all, and are very successful and prolific writers. And so it's really interesting to me to see the ways that people get to where they are. Yeah, I also really enjoy that.
I have a similar experience in that I went back to school to do my undergrad at 26. And I was doing it in English, but I was trying to take as many creative writing classes. The reason I was there was to learn how to write better and think about reading and writing better. So yeah, now I'm just about to turn 40 at the end of the year here, and I've released my first book. But I feel like the ways people interact with me, because it's my first book, everyone seems to just assume I'm a young writer, sort of, which could be my own misinterpretation of all of these things, but I just feel like it's hard to balance being like a new writer with also being a middle-aged man almost. But
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about, I mean, when people talk about, because you hear this a lot in the literary world, is like there will be like awards for emerging writers, and
yeah.
there's like calls for emerging writers, and I think it's important to really critically think about what emerging means, because emerging as a writer means you can be any age. You can be
Yeah.
any age to be emerging. And so yeah, I think that's a really good point, is like that shouldn't be associated with like youth.
Yeah. I also have to readjust my idea of emerging writer because I used to, anytime I came across some short story competition or like submit here, we're looking for emerging writers. That was my cue to be like, oh, maybe I could get something in here. But now I have a book published. So some of them, I kind of automatically go click the link and I think maybe I could submit something. But in the rules, it's like this is for someone who has not published anything. So I'm like, oh, maybe I can't do this anymore. But
Yeah, you're emerged now.
I've already emerged. Now I'm here. But that's also a cool problem to have for me.
Totally.
Yeah.
And congratulations on
Oh,
your book
thanks.
coming out as
Yeah.
well. That's very exciting.
Yeah. I'm pretty proud of that. As far as Bad Cree goes, were you writing with any sort of genre in mind? I mean, I found it on the spooky table. I've seen it called horror, magic realism, even mystery on one list. And of course, its regular spot in Indigo is just fiction or literature. To me, it feels like it could fit in any of these, but maybe it doesn't perfectly fit into any of them, except literature. Were you thinking about that, or did you even care about that? Who were you hoping would be your readers as you wrote it?
Yeah, it's so interesting to me to hear the discourse around Bad Cree and genre. And I love thinking about this because that's exactly right. Like there are some people who don't read scary things at all, and so will read Bad Cree and be quite spooked. And then there are people who are like avid horror readers and read Bad Cree and they're like, this isn't horror at all. Because your everyone's individual like scale of horror is a little bit different in their mind. And also, I've heard, yeah, I've heard people describe it as sort of like horror light, or it's like it's more like feelings horror than body horror, though there is that and the other aspects of horror that can sort of that typically come into that genre. I really loved you describing it as a love story because I certainly feel that way too. But when I was writing it, I actually wasn't trying to write into any particular genre at all. I think that what I was actually trying to do was write the genres that are most exciting to me, or the genres that I particularly really like. I do really love horror. I love like thriller mysteries. I do love those. And also, I love ca really character-driven stories. I love stories that focus on character development and character care. I love coming-of-age stories. I love sort of like, adventure stories in a way of like, self-realizations or self-actualizations. And so I think in many ways, this novel incorporates elements of all of them, and so doesn't necessarily belong specifically to any particular one. And I also think, in many ways, that's the nature of a lot of Indigenous literature. These are the genres, the typical genres we think about. They are, they're d developed and they devolve from, from like Greek traditions, these categories or these genres. They're made from their colonial constructs of what constitutes a story and how. And that won't always, Indigenous narratives or narratives from cultures that have different worldviews to that will just kind of inherently not belong. And I think that not belonging to that is really beautiful because that doesn't mean we don't belong anywhere. In fact, we belong to a very, very big tradition, and longer tradition of storytelling and storytellers that is different to that. And you know, we're building and we're building different ways and sort of forging different paths in that ways. In those ways, and you know, not just myself, but many other contemporary Indigenous writers and the Indigenous writers that came before us. And I think that is really exciting to see because it's surprising in so many ways. And I think just, yeah, the breadth of storytelling can be just really, really exciting.
Yeah, I've really found that with your book in particular, and then especially with the book Never Whistle at Night, which I know you blurbed, but all of the stories in there, Indigenous authors writing horror adjacent stories. But what I was taken with most about that book, being a white guy who's read a lot of books and has read a lot of short stories, maybe not horror, but going through that book, each story was so uniquely Indigenous that it was such a, I just found it to be, yeah, what you're saying, new ways of telling stories, or different to me of telling stories, that yes, they fit in the short fiction genre or whatever, but they're telling stories from a perspective that is just so different than what I experience in my everyday writing. And I love that. I love how you say, yeah, Bad Creek could fit here, there, and everywhere, but you're not trying to squish it into anything. And just telling the story from your perspective opens up all kinds of doors. It can go this way or that. I think that's pretty beautiful. I found there was so much going on in Bad Cree, especially reading it a second time. The first time, I was kind of stuck up in the mystery of it all, trying to figure out what's happening, trying to guess what's happening, trying to, all of those things. But then as I read it the second time, you're doing so much more than just telling a spooky mystery. Like I said, the love story became so much more evident on my second read through, and even just the ways you're subtly or not so subtly critiquing colonization and the oil field and all of that stuff. Like, I feel like the book is just doing so much, and I think that's exciting for me. I don't know if you want to reply to that. I don't know.
Thanks for that. Actually, you know, just going back to talking about you reading Never Whistle at Night, I love that collection. What I really loved about it, and in talking about how, you know, these different ways, these different storytelling ways, and like how exciting they are, I was talking to just an Inuk person the other day, and I was saying how particularly like how scary the Inuit stories are in that collection. Those ones particularly really, really scared me, and in a good way, because I love horror and I love to be scared. And I was saying, I was like, you know, I thought Cree storytellers had really scary stories because we have really spooky stories. I was like, but I had no idea that Inuit have the scariest stories. Like the further north you go, it's just like the scarier the stories get in my mind. And she had sort of laughed at that, and she said, yeah, we have, you know, really scary stories. It comes with the terrain. Like you need to, these stories are for you know, in a lot of ways, like scaring children into, you know, not going places that they shouldn't because of the very real danger that's there. And I think about how, I mean, those stories were really scary, but I think about in other forms of media, how this has really taken root because I'm just watching True Detective Night Country right now. And, you know, that there's, you know, Inuit storytelling in that as well. And I'm just, yeah, seeing all the places this is showing up and all the different ways that, you know, Indigenous storytelling is really being highlighted. And, I guess, like, I don't know, just shown to the greater public how brilliant our minds are is really, really cool to see.
Yeah, that is
That
cool.
wasn't so much about Bad Creek, but just thinking about this in general.
Yeah. Something I found fascinating about Bad Grief, something I really loved about the book, was the absence of a romantic love story. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, particularly since reading a book called Ace, which is about asexuality and society's relationship with sex and romance. And the author mentioned how it's nearly impossible to think of popular media, books, music, or movies, etc., in which romantic love is not at least a subplot of the story. And when they explicitly asked the question, "Can you think of any?" before listing five or six that they knew of, I immediately thought of Bad Cri. There's no romantic love, but as I mentioned in the intro and throughout our conversation so far, the story is full of all kinds of love stories. And I wondered if this was a deliberate choice, or if this story just came out the way it came out, or and if you think about stories like this that straight up don't care about romantic love at all, like is that, I don't know, it's a new fascination for me. I don't know if many people think about it, but I've been thinking about it a lot.
Yeah, you know what? I saw your TikTok talking about Ace, or mentioning it, and I saved it because I was like, oh, I want to pick that up. That sounds so interesting. But I mean, I think that's really true. There's so many of the media we consume. There is, yeah, a romantic storyline, whether that it be the main one or a subplot of some kind. It is pretty, it's kind of, there's like a default to that in a lot of ways, which like I love love stories and I love romantic stories. But it was a really conscious choice to not include that in Bad Cree. So I want to, it was a really conscious choice in Bad Cree to include many love stories,
Awesome.
which is the love story that is, you know, this family to each other. It's this love story to this land, actually both of them to you know, Coast Salish territories in Vancouver, as well as, you know, Treaty 8 territory. It's a love story about friendship because Mackenzie and Jolie's friendship is, you know, really the only thing tethering Mackenzie to the world when she is separated from her family and her territory and has nothing else. It's a love story to the lake. And I think that I was just really, really engrossed and sort of obsessed with showing the ways in which the web of kinship love that, you know, happens when you are tethered to community and tethered to humanity in the way that Mackenzie is, even when she tries to sever those kinship ties, or, you know, she erodes them in many ways because of you know, her own choices, that love still really remains. And I was more interested in that for this particular story. And all that being said, I mean, there's many ways that this love is very romantic, and not romantic in the sense of like sexual romance, or but like romantic as like the way that Jolie cares for Mackenzie is, and the way that they love each other is, you know, that's romance to me. It's romantic the way that this family loves each other. So there's certainly like an interpretation of romance, but it's not, I guess, a typical one. And it just felt really important to focus on that more than. It felt like if I wanted to try and put something like explicitly romantic, it wouldn't have fit. It would have felt like I'm trying to shoehorn something in, and I didn't want that to be the direction of the novel. I wanted it to feel organic in the way that it was meant to be.
Yeah, I think it works perfectly with I don't know how you could have squeezed that in without it feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the book is beautiful. Kind of along the same lines, maybe not exactly, but it was also interesting for me reading a book in which there's almost no male presence. Your dad is there, and he has like a line, "I'll save you some soup" or something, but most of the time he's out of the picture. And then Mackenzie's boss or supervisor had to give her the go ahead to leave for a few weeks. But other than that, it's like a strictly feminine book, which was just really fascinating for me. I don't know why, but Could you speak to that? Was that, I mean, I'm assuming that was intentional in some way, but
Yeah,
let's hear about that.
I definitely didn't accidentally leave men out. They were very intentionally left out. And yeah, I mean, there were a couple reasons behind that. Mackenzie's dad, yes, he does. He makes a bit of an appearance. He's, a silent background character in which you kind of just see him display just tenderness. He's quite tender with Mackenzie, and he's tender with her mom. And on the opposite side of things, you see, Brandon, this supervisor, just, this sort of misogyny and sort of, violence that he sort of exhibits in a lot of ways, and like not wanting to let Mackenzie take this holiday. She really has to advocate for herself, or not holiday, but leave. And first of all, in the Cree culture, we're traditionally matriarchal. And so, sort of centering a novel on Nehiyawiskwewek, Cree women, and femmes, because Jolie, though not Cree or a woman, a two-spirit trans character who is femme, that was really important to show the like, matriarchal power and both like organizing power, like power in love, power in solidarity with each other, that is, in our worldview, a very important cultural aspect of our society. So there was that. And also, I read books by characters that are predominantly men all the time. I mean, maybe not so much anymore, but like certainly there's enough of that out there. And that, so it didn't seem to me to I wasn't depriving the world of anything, because you can just pick up another book and there's your male characters and like go ahead with that. But I really wanted to highlight these women and femmes and their relationship to each other. And then in the instances where there are men, sort of show these like these different aspects to them. And there's also another scene where they see the men in the sort of like convenience store, this interaction. And these are, some of these interactions are interactions of violence, or this hint, this aura of violence that often men, and in these situations, white men, when they interact with these indigenous women, that they always exhibit. And this is a very, very real experience for indigenous women a lot of the time, is because there's also the scene where Mackenzie's mom, when they're scavenging in the house, and that
All
the
right, yeah.
man comes up, and her mom has a like the real fear and tension that there is around the fact that her mom is so aware of being a lone Indigenous woman with her young children there. Though nothing happens, he does leave them alone. There's this real fear of what could happen. And that's sort of always there. And yeah, it's very true to life. But then on the other side of that, I wanted to show sort of the softness of men too in Mackenzie's dad, who, is sort of a silent observer to a lot of this stuff. And also, isn't really helping, which is also can be a problem, So yeah, more than anything, it was just to show these, women's relationship to each other, and how, they really rally around and support one another. And maybe my next book will have men in it, but I make no promises.
I think you're doing fine without them. Just a side note also, I really loved how I went through your acknowledgments after, and I just really loved how you seem to name some of the characters after real life counterparts in your own life. So it just kind of adds to the beauty of it. And again, the love story there, it seems like not only the story itself feels like loving, all these relationships within the text itself, but I just felt like a real lovingness. I don't know how to say it, but like careful attention to feeling from the author writing the on another level. It just felt, especially on my second read around, where I was, slowing down and thinking about stuff a little bit more, it just felt so careful and gentle, even though it's like a horror story. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I imbued a lot of my own experiences into this novel as well. Like, setting it in, two places where I've spent a lot of my time, both in Vancouver and in High Prairie. And yeah, like you mentioned, the characters having also sharing the name of people from my real life and family members from my real life, which they've all noticed also. there is yeah, there's a bit of a mirroring in many ways. So I'm glad that came through.
Cool. I wanted to talk a little bit about the title also. Mac asks the question, "Am I a bad Cree?" early on in the book. I think when she's talking to Jolie, I should have marked it, but I didn't, and now I can't find the exact page. And then Mac's mom says it later towards the end of the book that she has been a bad Cree because she's had such a hard time letting her children grow and become the people they are without her interfering, sort of thing. Both are calling themselves bad in relation to ways they think they should be acting, but maybe aren't. I wondered if you'd want to sort of stretch out the title and talk about it. What does the idea mean to you, bad Cree? And why was it important for this to be the title?
Yeah, so the scene that you're talking about, she's talking to her auntie Doreen, and she asks her, because these things are happening to her, these really terrifying nightmare dreams, and she doesn't know why. And so kind of her default, thought, or she sort of defaults to assuming that it must be because she's bad, but specifically a bad Cree. And there's a lot that is behind that. I mean, it's very clear in, she talks about, learning how to smudge and these things that are happening to her, she assumes are cultural, but like she doesn't know why. And the reason why she doesn't know why is because of, if you know the history of, Indigenous people in Canada and even across the medicine line down into the United States, the history of violence of the Canadian state and settler colonialism in these in, on this land. And so for many reasons, for many of those specific reasons, she has been, displaced and separated from her own cultural knowledge for a very long time. Like this is of course this relates to residential schools and the 6C scoop. This is also like, in very real and ways that displacing Indigenous people and stopping Indigenous people from practicing their culture still exists in our society in ways like, the child welfare system and the prison, the mass incarceration of Indigenous women and men, and also in our laws. Like it was still not that long ago that it was like illegal to practice cultural ceremonies in urban spaces and still trying to do it. There's so much red tape around doing it. Even, erecting a teepee somewhere in Edmonton is like requires a lot to happen. And so, because of these reasons, there's just like severing at so many different levels of her life and existence, of her own knowledge. And knowledge she has an inherent right to. Cree people from the before they're born have a right to the knowledge of their own cultures and their own language. And we're denied that right all the time. And so that lives in her as guilt. She thinks this is her fault in some way, although we know as readers that this fault doesn't lie with her. This fault lies with the Canadian state's, settler colonial violence. But, and I mean, none of this is spelled out also in Bad Cree. It is brimming under the surface. She is thinking, I must be a bad Cree. And behind that thought is, years and years of ways that the Canadian government has tried to shame Indigenous people into thinking that these things are their own fault. And so she thinks, I should know what's going on with me. I don't, therefore I'm a bad Kree. And throughout her sort of journey of figuring out what's going on to her is also this journey of realizing that this shame isn't something that belongs to her. And even when her mom reflects on this and thinks, she even knows, she's like, I know that these, we take care of sky beings, Awasis, children. We take care of them until, we are supposed to let them go. We're supposed to care for them, but let them be their own people. And she has a hard time with that. And again, for reasons that are when, her mom would have been taken from her cookum to residential schools, and that trauma lives on in your body. Of course, you're going to be scared of your children going off on your own. That's you now have a very real, blood memory that lives in you of, why that's such a terrifying thing in a world that, does not value your life, in a society that doesn't value your life. So they are both sort of struggling with that. And so, Mackenzie thinks, yeah, I must be some sort of bad Kree. And I think and hope that, they both, in their reconnection with each other and in sorting out the mess that is sort of their own conflicts, that they sort of start to believe themselves as, or at least they start to interrogate the binary of what it means to be good and bad.
One thing I think kind of goes along with this that I really picked up on my second go around with the book was the idea of dreams and dreaming, and how each of the characters seem to have a different way of dreaming, each of which they kept from each other. So they all had sort of maybe supernatural ways of dreaming, but they thought it was something they had to keep to themselves. On my first go around, that was part of the mystery for me, so that when we found out, I don't want to spoil it exactly, but we found out the end. I kind of putting it down the first time thought, okay, all of the mystery at the end where we find out what's happening explains the dreams and everything. But then on my second go around, I was thinking about how, in fact, the dreams are completely separate from the bad guy, whatever. And that this has been going on for a long time, even generations, and that it's a part of who they are and part of their culture. As I was preparing for this, I read that you wrote the first short story that the novel was based on, partially in response to a prophet that said dreams aren't good short story material or something like that. I don't know exactly what I'm saying here, only that I appreciated or was fascinated by this idea that they each had a very similar thing that they were sort of ashamed of or afraid of or felt like they needed to keep secret. But when it was out in the open, then they realized this is something that brings them together and bonds them in a way that almost nothing else can. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of another thing with that shame piece, is that they do, they are a very close family, but they each are sort of keeping something from everyone else. And the reason why they keep it isn't because they don't trust their family. It's because, again, this world, and violence from settler colonialism has led them to believe that whatever is happening to them either isn't real, or that there is something wrong with them, or whatever, that makes them either try to make those things stop, as Mackenzie's mother does, or just hides them completely, just stops, just doesn't tell anyone about them. And again, it's a shame that doesn't belong to them. But once they're able to tell each other, and share with each other what's going on, they sort of, there's a reframing that happens. I think, Mackenzie, or not Mackenzie, Tracy or Cassidy says it, where, they say, stop looking at this as a curse and think of it as magic. Like, what we have is magic. And that to Mackenzie, of like, you think this thing happening to you is bad, but look at what we can all do. That's passed down in our blood. That's something that's beautiful. And I think that is such a great reframing for Mackenzie, who and all of them who do hold this shame, right? And dreaming for Nehiyawak is really important in our culture, and is our ability to do many, many things, such as speak to our ancestors, and is our connection to the stars as star people. And that's, the stars is where our creation story lives. And, you know, these things are all interconnected in our worldview too. So being able to represent that in a way in this novel was really important.
Yeah, really interesting. Well, is it true that this was in response to someone saying dreams are not good story material?
Oh, yeah. So I had a professor at UBC who had, you know, he gave the advice, which he thought was very good advice, and I disagreed, obviously, that to never write about your dreams. He said that writing about your dreams will lose your audience. It's very boring, he said. And yeah, that really enraged me as a Cree woman who knows that's not true. So I was like, I'm going to write a story that centers dreaming, that is very exciting. And I wrote a short story. I wrote Bad Cree as a short story. It's very different to the novel that it expanded into, but the same premise. And so I wrote that, and I really loved the story, and it didn't leave me, which I knew meant that I needed to spend more time on it, and that it wasn't in its like final form. But also, you know, when I was expanding it into the novel, I knew that I had to shift away from centering this man who, you know, said this thing, and I was, and this was like a response.
Yeah.
And instead I needed to shift that and instead center what I really wanted to write about, which was dreaming, but also kinship and love. And I kind of had to let him go and let that go in order to, you know, focus on the important things in expanding into the novel.
Yeah. That's another really interesting thing about writers and the writing process, and like where inspiration comes from a story. Like some of the stories in my collection were from writing classes and just a writing prompt, write about this thing. And I mean, that's not the same as writing to subvert what someone has said, but just some of my favorite stories just come from someone else saying you should write about this thing. And I think that's just a wild thing, because people think about writers as these like inner looking people who want to write what they're, you know, but actually someone just told me to write the story, so I wrote it and it turned out to be okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was a prompt in its like definition of a prompt, right? Yeah. So yeah.
So we're going to move into the penultimate segment now. This is something I do each episode that is fun for me. I try to specify this segment to each guest, so I wouldn't ask Jessica Johns the same thing I'm asking Emily Austin or whatever. So this one, we don't have a ton of time, so here it is. I'm wondering about the jigsaw puzzles. Your TikTok handle is Puzzle Gremlin, and the majority of your vids seem to be of making puzzles or more often breaking puzzles. So where did your love of puzzles come from? And is it a big part of your life the way your TikTok makes it seem it is? Or
I love puzzles. I love puzzles so much. You know, if ever anyone ever wants to get me a gift and they're like, oh, what do I get you? I'm always like, get me a puzzle. I truly always, at every point, every day of my life, I have a puzzle always going, always. This started a few years ago. I mean, puzzles have always been a part of my life because at Christmas, one of our like family traditions is we always have a puzzle going from like as soon as, you know, Christmas Eve or the day before, whenever we get to my parents' house, and we work on it until it's done. And, you know, everyone will come and do it at different times. And, you know, so it's always been that. But then a few years ago, I just started doing a puzzle at home and realized how good it was for my brain. Because I just love them. I love, it's like solving small problems. You get the like dopamine hit every time you find a puzzle piece. It's also a way that I'm able to listen to read books via audiobook, and to listen to my podcasts and things that I love. the perfect time to do that. So
Yeah.
it's a really, when I need to regulate, when I'm feeling quite dysregulated, a puzzle, like just working on the puzzle and taking time to do the puzzle. It's like my favorite way to start my morning. I wake up every morning, I have my coffee over my puzzle for half an hour before I start my day. And it's beautiful. I cannot recommend it enough for anyone.
Cool.
My girlfriend doesn't have the same experience. She has ADHD too, so this might be a part of it, but she'll sit at the puzzle for like 10 minutes and she's just like, I can't do this anymore. This has been too long to try and do this thing. So not as loved by her, but that's okay because she helps me with the puzzle punches, which is the thing that I love to do and the content that I post most on TikTok, which is that when I started seeing the trend of just like lifting up your puzzle when you completed it.
Okay.
And so just practiced doing that for a really long time and finally got good at being able to pick it up. And then Dell, my girlfriend, also got really good at picking up puzzles. And then I don't know if it's because I'm an Aries, which means I'm chaotic, but I was like, wouldn't it be fun to just punch this puzzle? And so now we do the series. I have so many videos I haven't posted yet of just us punching puzzles. And it's, you finish a puzzle and normally you put it away. And that's not a fun way to finish a puzzle. A fun way to finish a puzzle is to punch the shit out of it. And we still f the worst part about it is that now we find puzzle pieces all over our house. So
Yeah,
like
that'd be
I
tricky.
was like watering a plant the other day that's like really high up on a high shelf. And I'm up there watering this plant and I find a puzzle piece that somehow got up there. And so if you lend out your puzzles after, or if you donate your puzzles after, which I do, then doing puzzle punch can be maybe a little bit difficult for the person doing the puzzle after you if you lose any pieces. But it is a sacrifice I'm willing to make for the fun of puzzle punch.
Awesome. I thought you were going to say sacrifice you're willing to make for the sake of content. Because
I
that's.
mean, I guess that too, but the funnest part is actually doing the puzzle punch. So,
That's just a weird bit inside of me now. Now that I have a certain following on here, I'm always like, it's like, I'm not happy about this, but almost everything I do, I'm like, hey, could I put this on TikTok or can I talk about this? I don't know. It's just this content creator thing is
oh, totally. I mean,
crazy.
you think about things differently.
Yeah.
When it comes to being online a lot, right? And when you especially when you are a content creator. So
Yeah. Do you have a like a certain size of puzzle that you like, or do you try to do bigger and bigger, or how does
yeah,
that work?
so for the size of my table, 1,000 to 1,500 are ideal for the size of my table. However, I really want to challenge myself this year and do more like bigger puzzles. So I really want to do a 2,000, and then by the end of the year, I want to be doing 3,000 piece puzzles. That
Yeah.
is my goal.
Goals.
Yes, exactly. So that is what I'm aiming towards, though I think we will need to invest in a bigger table in order to accomplish this, which I think is worth it considering the amount of time I put into my puzzles.
I saw a video on TikTok. I'm assuming it's because I watch your puzzle. I can't figure out why the algorithm would show me puzzles otherwise. But there's this woman who got in the mail, I think it was 30,000 or maybe 60,000 piece puzzle. So
Whoa.
it was in like, I don't know, there was like 100 different bags that she had to, it was wild. It filled up her whole floor, but you're not doing those, huh?
Yeah. How do you even? I mean, I don't even know how I would fit that in my house. Like, how
Yeah.
is it going down her hallway? Like,
Yeah. I'm having trouble remembering the finished product, but she was working on it. It really turned out to
whoa.
just be like maybe 100 smaller puzzles, because she would open one
Right.
bag, do that, open the second bag, connect it, open the third bag. Like it wasn't like a mountain of puzzle pieces that she had to dig through to find the corners or anything, but still.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I think about how many puzzles I do in a year, which, like, if I'm doing 1,000 piece puzzles, okay, and say I do 2 a month, that's 24 puzzles. That's 24,000.
Yeah.
So I
Yeah, she's
technically,
just doing it all at once.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, thanks for the chit chat about puzzles. I think I'm gonna. My dad has.
That's been my favorite question. No one has asked me about my puzzle obsession yet, so I appreciate
Cool,
that.
cool, cool. I might go borrow some puzzles from my dad. My
You
dad,
should.
he loves puzzles and he's retired now, so he kind of always has one on the go. So I've been
Hell
getting them
yeah.
for birthdays and Father's Day and everything like that. But
Yeah.
the last time I gave him one, my mom took me to the side. She's like, "Okay, we have enough puzzles now." I don't know if they don't have the storage or something, but anyway, I might steal some from him.
Oh, that's great.
So for the last segment, this is a thing based on a couple of the videos that I think have made me most popular on TikTok was when I was saying, if you tell me any of these books or your favorite books, it's friends off. So I give each guest who comes on the pod an opportunity to tell me some friends that or some books that they think might be friends off books. What do you think?
So I would say that I think that if I ask somebody like, oh, who are your favorite authors? And they list three or four, and every single one of them is a white male, then it will be friends off. So if they're like, oh yeah, Bukowski, Hunter S. Thompson, fucking, David Foster Wallace. If those are the first three, I'm like, I know there's some deeply rooted misogyny that needs to be worked out. It's fine if they're like, amidst a lot of other, they read a lot of other people as well. And those are just like, yeah, I do like their writing too. That's fine. But if those are the only ones that you're saying,
If
friends off.
you're stuck in the white male pile, then it's friends off. That's what you're
Then
saying.
I'm just like, yeah, then
Yeah.
it's friends off for me.
Do you have any friends on books? Books that you're loving now that you love in general or think of as your favorites, whatever you want. Friends on books.
Yeah, my friends on books. Yeah, I'm loving Mona Awad. I read Bunny and a couple months ago, and then very quickly moved on to Rouge. And I love them both so much. I think they're just absolutely stunning.
Have
In
you,
Bunny, oh, go ahead.
sorry, have you read 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl?
No, I haven't. It's on order though.
Oh, that's it. I have only read that one. I think I have Bunny on my shelf, but yeah, I like that one because it's connected short stories. It's pitched as a novel, I think, but it's short stories. But not to interrupt you, I just,
No,
that's
I really
my
want to
only
read that.
experience with the wad. Yeah.
Yeah, you should pick up Bunny because after so many like sentences, I would read it and I would just be like, no way, no way.
Yeah,
It
that's
was
the
so
best.
beautiful, or it was so poetic, or it was so like it was stunning. I was like, damn, a writer like this exists. I love that.
Cool.
I also read and loved Bad Fruit recently. That was really good.
Do you remember who writes that?
Oh, I can't remember. Let me
That's
look
okay.
it
I
up.
can just Google it.
It is Ella King, Bad Fruit by Ella King. That was really stunning. I also in, the sort of Canada Reads hype, I reread Shut Up, You're Pretty, because I read that when it came out a few years ago. And it's one of my favorite short story collections. I absolutely love it. And I reread it and then remembered why I love it so much because it is so, so, so stunning.
I should get to that. That's been on my TBR shelf for
Oh my God.
ages. I should get to that.
Read it. Read it. Tell me what you think. It is so amazing. I similarly to Mona Awad I would finish a sentence or paragraph and I would just be like, so good. And what else have I read lately? I think those are the big ones. I
Cool.
also, you know what? I also read Tom Lake by Ann Patchett,
Oh.
because one of my first sort of my first like introduction to Ann Patchett was Truth and Beauty, where she writes about her relationship to her writer friend, and I read it when I was like a young woman, and it was so formative for me in like somebody writing about really close women relationships. And so I read Tom Lake, and it was also really good. It was beautiful. Yeah, I love finding an author that I really love and then being able to go, that's, discovering, or I've heard of Mona Awad for years, but being able to, finally be introduced to her work and then being like, yes, I have other books to read is so great. And then also when it's somebody who's very prolific and has lots, it can be a problem because it's like, okay, now I have 20 books to read. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much. I think that's it, unless you have something you want to pitch at the end.
Yeah, no, there were just two more books that I'm reading right now that are really good. I'm reading The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Alain Pape, and They Called Me a Lioness, A Palestinian Girl's Fight for Freedom by Ahed Tamimi. And those are in very different ways, very captivating. I haven't finished them, but they're in progress and really, really awesome.
I read They Call Me a Lioness in October, I think. And that other one is on my list. I think I got it from the library, but yeah, all of that trying.
Yeah, I think it's been certainly very important. I mean, other than the, what Palestinians are asking of us, which is like to be active in terms of like visibility for, their voices and visibility of ourselves and showing up to things like protests and calling our representatives and all that kind of stuff. I think in addition to that, our own learning in terms of reading Palestinian voices and reading the history of, this occupation, the 75-year occupation and ethnic cleansing is also paramount to this longer journey of solidarity because it's not gonna end tomorrow, So I think just, that's been an important part of my own learning journey as well is thinking about how we show up as helpers and, in solidarity with, indigenous folks globally.
All right.
Thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful invitation. Thank you for inviting me to be on the pod.
Thanks for coming on. I mean, I just feel lucky that talking about books on TikTok has led to people saying you make a podcast has led to writers that I, respect and am in awe of at some points are now sitting here talking to me in my living room. This feels cool. I'm glad you came on.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I look forward to seeing more of your TikToks.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the conversation because I know I did. Stay tuned for more exciting interviews. See you next time.
Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett, Tim Blackett and friends.